A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world, and welcome back to the OMG MotoGP podcast. On the show today, we'll be reacting to the KTM rider news down at GasGas. Also, is the title fight now officially a two-horse race? And we've got more Marc Marquez and Honda split fallout, and doing it all alongside myself, Harry Benjamin, and former Grand Prix rider and British champion Keith Hewan. Very pleased to be joined by the MotoGP journalist, an Isle of Man TT winner, a Le Mans 24-hour podium sitter, and God forbid, another podcaster, Matt Oxley. Welcome, Matt. Thank you for taking the time and giving in to Keith's pleads to join us.
Oh, it was hardly a plea. It was it's an honour, as I say, to be the Grand Prix winner. Yeah. A literal Grand Prix winner on an independent independent motorcycle. Yeah, fantastic. Great to be with you, Harry. Great to be with you, Keith. Always happy to talk MotoGP and anything to do with motorbikes.
It's a really strange domain, though, for you, isn't it, Matt? I mean, we go back a bloody long way. There's no doubt about that, as you can see from the pictures if you're watching this on YouTube. But your written word is pretty much revered around the world. And here you are now appearing on a camera and speaking. It's quite tricky.
Yeah. I've got a good face for radio, let's say. So yeah, being on a camera is not my idea of fun, really. But there you go. All the sensible people will just be listening to the audio, I think, not watching us. We do go back a long time. When did you win the British 350 Grand Prix? 1981, was it?
I didn't win it, actually, Keith, Matt. I'm really pleased that you've elevated me from second place to first place.
Oh, sorry. That. Well, it was a moral victory because you were beaten by a factory bike.
That is true.
That's when I first started as a journalist, and literally we were using typewriters. So that's how old we are.
Wow. Have you still got any original typewriters?
None of the ones I use. I've got my first laptop, which is a Tandy 200, which was powered by 4 AA batteries. With about 5 lines of text on it. I'll go and get it from the garage if you want, but you probably don't want it. In fact, I've got it right here. No, anyway, carry on. So yeah, we go back a long time, and we're both fellow addicts. We've been into motorbikes since we were sort of racing, riding around on two strokes in the 70s, and here we are still in the 2020s, still just the same, really. Nothing's changed.
It's called passion. Brilliant. You've got to have some passion for sport.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't have passion for any other sport, really. It's just motorbikes. Just don't really care about anything else, you know.
Four wheels, dare I say?
No, not nearly dangerous. not dangerous enough. Yeah, not dangerous enough.
Moving swiftly on. well, look, I mean, a pleasure for you to join us. Really appreciate it. And you join us, obviously, it's been a pretty big week, couple of weeks in MotoGP land, and we spoke about it a lot in our podcast last week. I'm sure you've done the same. Marc Marquez officially splitting from Honda, but that's not the end of it. That's obviously big news. But Matt, what are you hearing over the last week or so from the fallout from this with Marquez? We all presume it's off to Gresini, but it's not actually confirmed yet, is it?
Well, there's nowhere else for him to go, is there? So I think, that's where he's going. What a week or two. I mean, the whole silly season kind of thing that kind of gets longer and longer every season just bores the shit out of me, basically. The thing is that everybody, it's Marquez to Red Bull, it's Marquez to KTM, it's Marquez to Gresini, Ducati. It's, back in the day, Barry Sheen, is he going to go to Honda? And the next week, is he going to go to Kawasaki? And the next week, is he going to go to Yamaha, And then when the story... when the rider finally signs, the paper or would now be a website say, we told you first. Look, we said 6 weeks ago that Barry Sheen was going to Yamaha. You know what I mean? And it's like, well, no, you also said he was going to Kawasaki, Suzuki, Triumph and bloody BSA, So, yeah, it just wake me up when everybody signs, basically.
Is it?
I want to see motorbikes going around. I really don't care about the bullshit, I really don't care.
I mean, obviously, you're a bit old school. I've worked with Julian Ryder, who's definitely old school as well. Julian always used to say to me, a story's not a story until it's been verified by two verifiable sources and so on and so forth. Does it really piss you off when you get the always on social media, you always get these guys that, like you say, speculate across all the platforms with all say whatever you like, and there is always a proportion of people who will believe it and who will subscribe to your channel because of the bullshit you're coming out with. Does that annoy you as a proper journalist?
Exactly. Yes, it does. It does. It really does. But I can remember, working for Motorcycle News all those years ago, where your job was to get the story of so-and-so signing to so-and-so. And you knew damn well that everyone you spoke to when it came to this kind of stuff in the paddock was lying to you. Whether it be the team manager, the rider manager, the rider, they all lie to you. Of course they do. They're not going to tell you the truth, are they? That's another reason why I find the whole thing pointless, because you're being lied to. You go, I just don't bother with it anymore, because what was true yesterday is no longer true today. So what's the point?
One of the things I love.
I do know that the fans kind of love it, but I just don't get it myself, because like I say, it's just bullshit. It's just, as I say, yesterday's news is today's blues, I'm here for the, I always say until the wheels are turning, I don't really care, that's what I'm here for. I'm here to see riders riding motorbikes and talk to the riders and talk to the engineers. That's what keeps me interested,
It might be because obviously, as a former, like you, a former racer, I mean, you've been involved in this as well. And I'm kind of trying to put this together now, because the business behind all of this is so important to make it actually come together. The business behind it actually still intrigues me quite a lot. And you follow the money effectively, but it's always the way that management are scurrying around in the background that interests me, where the money's going to come from, where the money's going to go to, where the new sponsorship's coming from, where the old sponsorship's going. And I think with the Marquez thing, to bring this conversation back on track, that is clearly one of the reasons why we're not getting any Gresini announcements at the moment, in as much as that those T's haven't been crossed and the I's haven't been dotted when it comes to the pound note side of things. I would imagine that there's a proper furore going on in the paddock at the minute with the shift in finance because of the Marquez shift.
Yeah.
I mean, do you sort of follow when you're working?
Well, of course, it is interesting. But like I say, I take it all with a massive dose of salt, because that most people in those situations are lying, because they have to. They can't tell you the truth, because they're kind of, they're trying to negotiate something, in the background. But what I found really interesting was Gigi Dall'Igna revealing to Sky Italia at Motegi that Marquez was leaving Honda to join Ducati. Now, that kind of thing never happens. It never happens, for a factory boss to say before a release has come out confirming, that the thing's been signed and everything. So to me, he was definitely trying to make something happen behind the scenes there, but by bringing that story out into the open to confirming it, I think he was trying to move Honda into a corner where they couldn't get out of, because that was completely unprecedented. So something clever was going on there. So I do find that kind of thing interesting. But the fact is that you'll never know the truth for another 5-10 years. When Gigi Delina writes his autobiography in 10-15 years, you'll find out what really went on. And I love that. But to actually find out what is really going on now behind the scenes is pretty damn difficult. But that was fascinating, him making that, because like I say, that was unprecedented. So he was definitely doing that for an ulterior motive, 100%.
The management are out in the open at the moment, aren't they, one way and another? We've got Lynn Jarvis out at the moment, who again is talking about satellite team, how keen they are. And he's mentioned VR46, how you know they'd love Rossi to beat Yamaha once again. That almost strikes me as being slightly desperate. I always feel that Yamaha just seem to be, out of all the factories, behind the game when it comes to their ladder of riders and where they're headed in the future.
Yeah, 100%. They kind of they've really lost that. And once you lose your satellite team, you're kind of stuffed. You know, you're going down. You just they're digging themselves a deeper and deeper hole. I think there's various reasons for it. You know, one of my my strong feelings speaking to various engineers is that you're never going to make enough power with an inline four anymore. You know, the more aero you carry, the more drag you create, and therefore the more horsepower you need, you know. So you need the aero to go around the corners faster. So now you don't only need horsepower to get you down the straights, you also need to get it around the corners, you know, to carry all that aero. So I think they're in a huge hole that way. And, you know, they've got this former Ferrari Formula One engine designer Luca Marmarini to design their 2024 engine, and we're all like, well, maybe this is their last chance to me with an inline four. And Quartararo said at Misano when you test it, couldn't feel any difference. So, you know, it's just once you get up to sort of 18,000 or whatever, an inline four gets a bit shaky, you know. So yeah, I think Yamaha are in a hole, and I don't know how they're going to get out of it.
Do you think, though, just to see, oh, that's Yamaha, just on the Honda stuff, though, we spoke about it last week. Are they in a bit of a hole now when it comes to who do they replace Marquez with? All because right. I know they've got Zarco going the LCR at the moment, but that could change. What do you see as the cards falling there?
Yeah, I mean, it's a massive, you know, the less competitive your bike, the harder it is to get riders to ride it. You know what I mean? If you're a good rider, if you're a top rider, you're not going to go to Honda now, are you? I mean, Zarco's a pretty good rider, but he's not one of the top three or four, is he? You know, he hasn't won. I hope he wins a Grand Prix before he leaves Ducati. I think Honda are also in a big hole. I think they're in the sort of hole that Ducati were when Stoner left in 2010, and it took from 2010 to 2016 for Ducati to dig themselves out of that hole. You know, I think Honda are in that same sort of position. I think 2-3 years maybe to get out of it. You know, they need to completely, basically Gigi Delina has completely transformed MotoGP since 2016. You know, it's a completely different game now. The European factories have gone with him. They're in his slipstream, but Honda and Yamaha are just like, what the hell's going on? What the hell's going on? Oh shit, we're getting our asses kicked, you know.
I think with Honda, the big surprise for me, and this is where they might be able to dig themselves out of the hole a little bit earlier, is that they seem to have taken on board a strategy that we've never seen the Japanese do before. As soon as we started seeing Kalex getting involved in making swing arms and bits and bobs as well, as soon as we started to see that outside of the factory, developments coming from an outside provider, that's a very unusual situation. Do you see that happening regarding their technicians as well, like buying in a Gigi Delina, or even somebody management-wise like Rivola that came into Aprilia that have turned them around as well? Do you see the Japanese factories perhaps being a bit more proactive in that direction?
If they want to win again, 100%, that's what they've got to do. They've got to, they've got to move their operations to Europe. You know, so I mean, I know Yamaha in Milan, they have, you know, quite a lot of 3D printing, CNC, you know, machines at Yamaha in their MotoGP team in Milan. So they can make stuff, but I think you've got to go further. I think you've basically just got to base your whole Grand Prix operation in Europe, you know. I mean, you could argue, well, only half the races are in Europe, but I don't know. The thing is, you're probably not going to get European engineers. I mean, I know Honda were chasing Delina. You know, you're not going to get European engineers to go and live in Japan, I don't think. You know what I mean? So I think you probably got to bring the team to Europe, you know? But 100%, they've got to go out and buy. You know, the only reason KTM are doing what they're doing now is because they bought a dozen engineers and so on off Ducati, you know? Come and tell us how they do it. And that's what they've done, you know? That's why KTM are so fast now, you know? But that's what you've got to do in racing. You know, you've got to do whatever it takes to win, you know?
Could you see a time coming, Matt, where they look at the books like Suzuki did and decide, well, that's it. Yamaha, we're pulling out? Because it does seem to me, and over a number of years now, not just recently, but it always seems like Yamaha, I won't say made a less effort, because I think everybody to a man has worked extremely hard within the factory and on site. But it does seem like they've been half-hearted, if I can put it like that, in their efforts to move things forward. And it seems like they've relied too much on past performance and past technology. And they've not moved it forward. Could you see them doing a Suzuki where suddenly they go, hang on a minute, we've done the math, we've looked at it, you know, the amount of money it's going to cost us to get somewhere, we don't believe that's the future, and they pull out?
I mean, anything can happen. I mean, it's all speculation. But you know, if Suzuki can do it, why not Yamaha? I'm not sure where their current contract ends. Whether it's at the end of the current rule cycle, which is 2026 into 2027, their contract with Dorna. But I mean, you know, anything can happen. I mean, the I kind of liken it to what happened in the early 60s when the Japanese arrived, you know, in Europe with their, you know, new motorcycles, and the British industry was like, nah, we've got nothing to worry about. You know, they can build little scooters and stuff, but they're no way they're going to be able to build big bikes like us. And then, you know, five years later, they're all bankrupt, you know. And I kind of see, I'm not talking about the factories, I'm talking about the, you know, in MotoGP, I see that they're in a similar situation, that they've just come along. The Europeans have just changed the game, and the Japanese are still sitting there like, holy hell, you know, what just happened? You know, so maybe. I mean, I know that Honda and Yamaha and Suzuki, none of them were keen on the aero thing. You know, none of them wanted it to happen, because they've, you know, they get their budget from their from the parent company to go racing on the basis that what we're doing here is helping produce better road bikes. And they all went, well, this stuff isn't helping produce better road bikes, so we can't really sell it to the management. So they didn't really want to go down that road. But, you know, ultimately, if you want to win, or needed to do KTM, but they realized that's just what you got to do. You know, if you're going to win, you got to do what the winners are doing, you know.
I floated an idea in our last conversation. Me and Ari did on an extra that we do on a Friday that goes out. I think that the manufacturers in their group, if you like, of that basically make the rules and have to unanimously agree amongst themselves where it's all going. I personally feel that there should be a situation where that's changed to a majority, so that you get more flexibility 100%. In what can or can't be achieved in the next set of rules.
Of course, 100%. I agree 100%. It's a ridiculous way to run a rule system where you have you have to have unanimity amongst all the people involved. That's just stupid. You know, you can have, what we've got, five manufacturers at the moment. You can have four voting one way, wanting answer A, and the other one wanting answer B, which is the current situation or whatever, and the single factory wins the argument against the other four. It's just stupid, you know. It really is. But that was brought in the early 90s when Dorna came in and they were doing the contracts with the factories and everything, and that was seemed as the best way to kind of look after the stakeholders, i.e. the factories. But to me, it's just, they need to get rid of that, because it's put MotoGP in a real kind of it's just a technical mess at the moment, I think.
Do you see the future? I mean, we've got Mike Trimby, who sadly we lost him a couple of weeks ago now at Misano. Camilo Espeleta is not a young man. His son is a bright young thing and looks like he's going to be the next Carmelo. But do you see a sea change in things regarding the management? Do you see things changing massively in the very near future because of the old school, if you like, are rolling over a bit?
100%. I think we're kind of, you know, I mean, MotoGP's been a business for as long as you or I can remember. You know, I mean, it's, you know, racing is always a business. You know, people are doing it to try and make money, whether that's the riders, the promoters, the mechanics, you know, everybody's in it trying to make money, trying to make a living out of it. And MotoGP's become incredibly professional. You've got a huge paddock now. I mean, you know, when you were Grand Prix racing, the paddock was probably 300 people, you know, and now it's probably 3,000. So that's wonderful. You know, that all those people are getting to work doing their dream. But I do feel that everything's becoming more of a business and less of a sport, you know, and you could just say that's inevitable. That's the way with everything. It's the same. It's look at sprint races, for example. The riders and the teams, who are the guys that make the show? You know, no one else makes the show. Dorna just film it, you know. I'm not being nasty to Dorna. I think they do a magnificent job in many, many ways. But, you know, to completely change the game without consulting the riders or the teams was just beyond to me. I mean, like, what the hell? You know what I mean? You know, and that, I don't think Carmelo would have done that. He was... so I think everything's becoming a bit more business. You know, it's just like, basically, here you go. You know, if you don't like it, piss off somewhere else, basically. And you know, fair, you know, everyone's got to make money. But I, you know, I think you do need to respect the people that are making the show and taking the risks, i.e. the riders and, you know, and the teams. You know, I mean, this going into this mad, a mental sort of 6 races and 7 weekends on 4 different continents. No, sorry, 12 races over 7 weekends over 4 continents. I mean, you know, not everybody flies business class, you know. A lot of these mechanics are going to be in a mess by the last couple of rounds. And you don't want riders, mechanics, making mistakes on bikes that do 220 miles an hour, do you? You know? So, yeah, no, it's definitely going more business, and fair enough, you know. That's just the way it is, you know.
It's a very, very good point, isn't it? We've had a couple of questions come in off the back of all this Marquez news as well, and the Japanese-European debate. Archie has got in touch and says, could there be a surprise twist and KTM swoops in to buy Gresini?
Well, this is another weird...
Who wants
weird...
to stab at that one?
Yeah, this is another weird thing that... Dorna didn't want Marquez to go to KTM, so that's why they told KTM you can't have another a team, because Dorna are terrified, quite rightly, that Honda would leave. So they're like, right, we've got to do whatever we can to keep Marquez at Honda. So no, you can't have an extra team, KTM. So that blocks that door for Marquez. But then in the end, he goes to Gresini Ducati. But the weird thing is that Gresini only renewed its Ducati deal at the end of June, when all this story was already out. Everybody knew Marquez wanted to, you know, that was a rumor that everybody didn't know. It was the rumor. So why didn't Dorn appoint Gresini in the direction of KTM at that point? I just don't understand. It doesn't add up. You know, when Carmelo Espeleta writes his autobiography in 10 years or so, maybe we'll find out. But yeah, I mean, so it could have been Gresini KTM, which would have been fantastic, because then you would have 6 KTMs and 6 Ducatis. And that would be better than 8 Ducatis and 4 KTMs, you know. But yeah, who knows what goes on in those offices? I have no idea. We can only guess.
Well,
they should stick it all on YouTube, I reckon.
Well, the transparency thing is a major problem, isn't it? I mean, I've been trying to get to the bottom of why we couldn't have the two extra KTM situations, and I get conflicting answers from all of that. And now that Mike Trimby obviously was a good friend of ours, and as much as Mike wanted to help us with information, there are certain things that he knew that he wouldn't even tell his mates. And you could never quite get to the distinct bottom of why. Interesting that you say that Dorna didn't want another KTM situation because of Marc Marquez leaving. It'd be interesting now whether we get in the future another couple of slots that appear, and if they do appear, then we know that your theory may well be right there, Mr. Obsley.
Yeah, I mean, the other reason why Dorna didn't want to put another independent team out there is because they have to finance them. You know, Dorna finance is, you know, which is a fantastic... You know, we look at Formula One and Premier League football and so on. All the money goes to the top, you know. And massive props to Dorna for coming up with a system where it basically finances all the independent teams to the tune of several million each a year. But they didn't really want another independent team that they'd have to, you know, finance. So whether that will happen at in the future, I don't know. But to me, the biggest thing MotoGP needs now more than anything is Mark Marquez back at the front, you know. Because wow, you know, I one of the reasons, the various reasons the racing has become more processional in recent years, but one of them is the fact that Marquez isn't there stabbing it up the inside wherever he can, you know.
But is there a worry that with Marquez on a Ducati, he's just going to walk it and then it's just going to be Marquez winning every race now?
Well, the great thing about that is Gresini's not the motorbike that Pramac have got. I mean, we're talking about, I mean, I'm sure that Ducati are going to weigh in fairly heavily at Gresini, but they're a bit further down the pecking order when it comes to the equipment level at this point. I can see that changing come next year.
Well, that's the thing. The worst thing that could... Sorry, go on, Harry.
No, Matt, please. You're way more informed than I am.
Seconded.
No, I wouldn't say that. Gresini, yeah, so they're down the pecking order. The one thing that could really muck things up for Marquez next year is if the GP24 is way better than the GP23, which I doubt it will be, because there's so little testing time now that you can't make radical changes. You have to just tweak, because they get what, five or six days of pre-season testing. I mean, it's crazy. So you can't come up with something completely new, you know.
Well, like, you know, Matt, it's going to be amazing that we haven't talked about this privately at some stage in the past. I'm an advocate of the homologation point being two or three Grand Prix into the season, not at the point where we get to the first Grand Prix where that's, you know, you've now got your technical cutoff point here. I believe that it should be further into the season, particularly now we're having long seasons. Let's have, so that they can do, if they want to, some testing and some jiggery pokery in the first 3, 4, 5 Grand Prix.
Yeah, not a bad idea. Not a bad idea. I mean, I think that there needs to be, you know, for the sake of the championship, something like that. Because, you know, because now if you get it wrong at the first race, that's it. You know, if what you homologated for the first race, i.e. your engine, which is the heart of the motorcycle, still is, you know, aero, whatever, the engine is still the most important thing, you know. If you get your engine wrong, that's you stuffed for the whole year, you know, and you've got no chance to dig it. So rather, I always thought they should allow one engine update a year halfway through the season, so that, you know, at least you wouldn't be stuffed for the whole year. You know, you've messed up, so you're going to suffer for half the season. But
they need,
you know,
testing. At least
then you'd be able to get... Sure, yeah. No, I mean, your idea is not a bad idea. Not a bad idea. It would certainly make the first few races pretty crazy.
Keith, not having a bad idea?
The thing, of course, is cost, you know, and that's what they're trying to minimize. But there is a balance somewhere. You know, there's a balance somewhere. And as for Marquez, how's he going to go on the Ducati? Well, is he going to leave everybody for... Assuming the GP24 is not dissimilar to the GP23 that Marquez will have, you know, without a doubt he'll be up the front. And I know Gresini isn't a top team, but if I was Marquez, you know, he'll be bringing a ton of Red Bull money with him and stuff. If I was Marquez, I'd be investing some of that money in the team, because Gresini's a good team. I mean, look what it did with Bastianini last year, and it won a sprint this year with Alex Marquez. It's a good team. But I think Marquez will want it to be better. And, you know, and I think, you know, he really doesn't... I don't really think he gives a toss about money right now. You know, I think he'd happily ride for nothing. You know what I mean? He'd invest all of his money that he's getting from Red Bull into the team to make it. Because all he wants to do is go out there and kill everyone again, like he used to do in the past. You know, that's what he wants to do. That's the way he is. You know, he's... and will he... You know, the nice thing about the Ducati is that everyone can ride it. You know, now it's the complete opposite to what it used to be. You know, now it's the bike that it used to be the bike that no one except one man in the world could ride, and now it's the bike that everyone can ride. And so I think Marquez will get the hang of it pretty quickly. I mean, you look at what his brother did, and you know, his brother's a twice world champion, but he isn't the same as Marc Marquez. You know, Alex was straight away on it. you know, on you know, fast. So I think next year, oof, I mean, yeah, it could be fantastic. And Acosta going to Gas, you know, I think it's with rookies, just give the guy a bit of chance, you know. When Acosta went to Moto2 and had a real struggle, his first half season in Moto2 was a struggle, and everybody's going, ah, he's lost it, he's not as good as everybody thought he was, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? It's just mental that people kind of just jump to those conclusions. If you don't just jump on a completely different motorcycle and instantly know.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Nail it, you know, then you've obviously lost your skills, which is nonsense. So I think Acosta will get there, but much of it will depend on whether KTM can keep up its rate of progress to kind of keep getting closer to Ducati, which won't be easy.
Well, you've taken us there, Matt. With this KTM news, Keith, that Gas are getting rid of Pol Espargaró to make way for Pedro Acosta. It's that sort of they've gone against what they've normally done, and they haven't sacrificed another rookie this time around. They're keeping Fernandez. It was inevitable that Costa was going to make that step up, but do you feel a bit for Pol's side?
No, I don't feel a bit for any rider at the end of the day, because I've been there and I know what it's like. It is a business. Matt's already hit on that. And at the end of the day, if you're not performing, you start to move around. We talked about it last time. If a factory's not happy with a rider, they'll let him go. If a rider's not happy with a factory, they'll generally find a way out. It kind of finds its own level at the end of the day. I think where Pol will be particularly cheesed off is that KTM is a coming. You know, that carbon frame straight out of the box was something that worked, and that can only get better. KTM might steal a march from this point onwards. We'll wait and see how that develops. You know, they could be the manufacturer of next year without any doubt. I think there's a lot of people that are going to be running slightly scared of what KTM have achieved. They've invested heavily. They've got the right people on site. And where Pol Espargaró will be really, really cheesed off is he's going to lose an opportunity to be on that wave, that crest of a wave. And I think that's, from a rider perspective, that's horrible. In Acosta's case, he was the man, wasn't he? He was going to move on through. And I always work on three-year cycles in my brain for riders. You know, the first year, win a world championship. Yeah, everybody's shouting and hollering and being on your back and saying how wonderful you're going to be. And then the second year, it's bloody hard retaining a world championship. You ask anybody that's done it. The second year is hard. By the time you get to your third year, if you've managed to do it on a third year running, you are truly a world champion superstar. But it's not as easy as all of that. And I think with manufacturers heavily investing, particularly in Europe at the moment, the European war is really hotting up. And the KTM are looking like they're going to be right at the forefront of that come next year. And then, Matt, we've got all the rule changes in 27. You alluded to it a bit earlier on. This big contract ends in 26. 27 is all the new stuff that comes out, all the things that are being written and talked about behind the buses at the moment that we're not party to, but it's all being discussed now. It's going to be interesting to see what shape that takes. Then we move into the domain of what tracks are going to be safe and whether we're going to be going back to some of the traditional tracks or whether we're moving slightly more east and so on. I mean, yeah, you got to look at Qatar. I mean, why Qatar has even got a Grand Prix, I don't know. I mean, I won't get into politics because I know Matt and me will argue like hell, but Qatar is just an awful place, and we shouldn't be having a Grand Prix there, in my opinion, at all. We've just come off the back of a Formula One Grand Prix where, you know, they've They've done whatever they've done to the track. It's slippery. The curbs aren't quite where they ought to be. We've not got the Misano curbs. They're going to have to dig all the curbs up before we get there for MotoGP, because the curbs they've got there are those ridiculous, harsh things. And even with Formula One, they had compulsory bloody pit stops because the tyres weren't lasting when they were running out onto the curbs. So it's a slightly different thing with the bikes, of course. It's dangerous to the rider rather than to the tyre. But there are issues. Yeah. I'd vote for not even bothering going to Qatar any time of the year.
Well, there's a few places we go to where you know, there's a lot of reasons not to, but we, you know, it's a business and Dorna needs to make a profit. And if it can go to places where it can make a lot of money, you know, we're going to be going to Saudi in a couple of years, aren't we? So, you know, it's the sport washing thing that's everywhere now. It's just the way it is. And, you know, it pisses me off, but I kind of just try to think about the motorbikes, really. About the curbs, you know, if anybody's seen them, the curbs they put in at Qatar, that they are evil, like the dragon's teeth that Keith, you just about stopped by then, I think, about sort of late 80s, early 90s they came in. And, you know, if you crashed and slid down the curb, basically you were going to break an arm or a leg, because they were like little pyramids, and you just go, you do that at 100 miles an hour, it's gonna rip you to pieces. So they're going to need to change those curbs to the Misano curbs for the MotoGP. Now, I thought that recently the FIM and our governing body and the FIA, the car governing body, have been much more sitting down together to discuss safety. Let's find a common ground so we can make the track safe for us and for them, you know. And these curbs are just completely the opposite of that. You know, if that's the way Formula One's going to go with the curbs, and we need the softer curbs, the less aggressive curbs, they're going to have to dig up the curbs at every circuit between the F1 and MotoGP every year. I mean, how insane is that? I mean, in Qatar, it's not a problem because they've got more money than they know what to do with, and they've got semi-slave labor to do the work. So, you know, it's not a problem. But you come to Europe or whatever where you have to pay people a proper wage and there's countries aren't as rich, it's going to be a huge problem, you know.
I think after Qatar, Formula One this weekend, and obviously the problem they had with the tyre manufacturer there, probably going to find a bit of a rethink going on in Formula One regarding their curbing. I think it might be moving more towards the Misano curb just by default because of the problems they had with the frequency that this rumble strip was putting through the tyre that was. And apparently you couldn't even visually see a problem. It was something when they broke them down back in the old technical department, they could see that the construction was weakening because of the frequency of the movements that they were getting off of the tyres. Like I say, we ain't worried about any of that because we're not going to be bouncing off of the curbs unless we're sliding across them on our backside. So it's a different thing altogether. But all the same, you're right, it's costly to have to change, put the wrong curbs in. That's a big old deal.
Microscopic were, that was the only way they could see the damage on the Pirelli tyres in F1. And these were actually new curbs they were trying out in Qatar. They're not at every track. These were new curbs to try and deter drivers from exceeding track limits. Didn't really work. And then obviously these curbs ended up basically crushing the tyres over and over again, and that continued to happen, and then it had to be a minimum 3-stop race, and it was very, very confusing. Let's not unlock the F1 can of worms, but you're absolutely right when it comes to that stage. I think there's going to be rethinking across the board there. Coming back to MotoGP, also some news, Matt, in the last, was it over the weekend? Bezzecchi injured. What do we know, and does this make the title race simply between Pecco and Jorge now?
I think it happened on Saturday, the usual, ranch training session. So that it's not motocross, as far as I know. You know, they're doing dirt track around that fantastic, I went there a few years ago, just fantastic dirt track circuit. It's not just a circle. It's like it goes all over the hills, lefts and rights, and it's just awesome. You know, that's where all the VR46 riders race, and they do race. You know, I'm just seeing it. They're kind of, you know, they're more vicious than they are in MotoGP quite a lot of the time. A, because they're going slower, but B, because there's no race direction. They can just do whatever they like to each other. So it gets pretty gnarly, you know. And I don't know the exact circumstances of the crash, but he just presumably lost it, crashed and broke his right collarbone. He's had it pinned and plated. And I think people might already know by the time this pod comes out whether he's going to ride at Lombok this weekend. I mean, it's not just the fact of him having had this big operation, but it's a fairly serious operation. I'm going to Lombok tomorrow, and it's going to take me 33 hours to get there. So, you know, if you've just come out of a hospital and then you've got a 20, let's, I've got a bad connection in one of the stops I have to make, which is why it's taken me that long. But it's still going to take you kind of 20 hours, something like that. So, you know, and then racing, you know, you really want to do that straight after an operation? If I was a surgeon, I'd be like, well, yeah, if it was Jerez and you just had to jump on Pecco Bagnaia's private jet and whiz down to Jerez with him, cool. But, you know, that hugely long journey, just straight after an operation, you know, with a healing collarbone. But and also, you know, even if he does ride there, he's not going to be at his best, I don't think. You know, he's 54 points behind. It was a two horse race anyway between Pecco Bagnaia and Jorge Martin, but he was a kind of wild card. Bezzecchi was a wild card, and he is a wild card. You know, he was 50 points behind, still in with a shout and nothing to lose. That's what you want, isn't it? So you've got two guys with everything to lose who are like trying to duke it out with each other. And then you throw in a guy in the middle that's got nothing to lose. And that's the kind of scenario you want, isn't it? That's what's going to be super exciting, having this, you know, Marco Bezzecchi. And he is a bit of a nutter. I love him. You know, he's just such a sweet, cool guy. And got such a lot of charisma. You know, he's like the kind of the bastard son of Valentino Rossi and Marco Simoncelli, basically, isn't he? You know, so it's super sad to lose him out of the title fight, really is. As for Bagnaia Martin, who knows? I mean, Martin's definitely on a roll at the moment. But, you know, Keith will know, keeping that roll going isn't easy, is it? You know, you get into a kind of psychological state where you go from one race to the other and you're just going boom, boom, boom. And then you go to the next race and, you know, maybe you had a nice week's holiday with your girlfriend on the beach or whatever and you've just lost it. You know what I mean? You kind of, you've just, your brain has moved out of that zone and suddenly you're not there anymore. So it's going to be fascinating. And you know, the fact they're both on pretty much identical bikes, well, they are on identical bikes, it's going to be very cool, I think. I mean, you know, let's hope that it's that they both go all the way without it being decided by, you know, a crash or a breakdown or something like that. Let's just hope that they're kind of on it all the way to Valencia or, you know, wherever.
I've got the feeling there will be freezing cold Valencia at the end of November. Bezzecchi, several things for Bezzecchi, really. I mean, like, he lost 10 points last time out. You know, went from 44 to 54 adrift, which is an issue, obviously. Plenty of points still left. But one of the things that concerns me most about that long haul business, the mechanics of that shoulder will have been fixed. They'd have bolted that, no problem at all. But it's the infection side of things that you pops up now and again. And if he does do any damage while he's away in Lombok, it's that care that he would be looking for while he's away. So it's a risk and reward situation, isn't it? So I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't go. But then again, based on what you've just said anyway, Matt, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if he does go either, to be honest, and gives it a go, because he is that kind of lad, and you would hope that would happen. Regarding Jorge Martin and Bagnaia on the same bikes, I mean, I do really think at the moment that Jorge Martin has shown us some toughness, and Pecco Bagnaia has not got to rethink, but he's got to really, really, really now be concerned about his hit rate, because it's dropped massively in the last few Grand Prix, just when Jorge Martin is peaking. Pramac is a lovely, lovely team to ride for. It's got that kind of atmosphere about it. It's got that kind of laid back yet professional manner. It really does for me. It hits all the traditional marks for motorbike racing. You know, fun off the track, great on the track. I do love the way they go about their business. When you're on the big red bikes, you know, you got Giabatti in the team, you know, Domenicali sometimes, all the rest of them all stood in there with their bloody shirts on and they're all in red. And it does have a tension about it that, to be honest, is quite intimidating. And if you're just dipping a little bit at the moment, Bagnaia's wounding himself from several directions, from his own and from the management point of view. I know which team I'd rather ride for if it was just for fun and games, and that would be Pramac by a mile.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I agree that it's probably a more comfortable place to be. You know, being in the factory team is always a lot of pressure. And like you say, you got Chabatti in there, you got Dalinha in there. They're both pretty serious people. You know, who a bit like being at school. I kind of, you know what I mean. And kind of looking up, and there's two sort of tough masters standing down looking at you going, and you know, that's probably not great for your sort of psyche. I mean, I like both of them for different reasons. You know, Pecco is, you know, he's the least motorbike racer looking bloke you've ever seen, isn't he? You know, if you saw him just walking down the street, you wouldn't, you know, you'd just think, oh, that's some kid going off doing whatever. Whereas you look at Martin and he's just like a bloody cage fighter, isn't he?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And my God, the way he's been riding, I mean, they've been so kind of equally matched. I mean, in the rain at Motegi, he was just sensational. I mean, to be in the front the whole way, pretty much, I think, after he ran off, didn't he? He went all the way down to eighth and fought his way back up to first. I mean, bloody hell. You know, that's pretty amazing. And then Bagnaia was just behind him, lap after lap after lap after lap after lap, and he didn't make one single mistake. You know, in the rain at Motegi, that is so easy to make a mistake there, and he didn't. And like I say, he's in the zone at the moment, and if he can keep it in the zone, which, like I say, isn't easy, then I would say he would be my favourite, but not by much, because the kind of pressure they're under, it's so easy for either of them to make a mistake. And, you know, one mistake and it's probably game over, isn't it?
GRYF1 says, how much closer do you think Bez would be if he was on the latest factory bike?
I don't think it makes an awful lot of difference. I think the thing with Bez is that this is only his second season. You know, you've got to remember that. Yeah, no, absolutely. It's his second season. So he's still learning, you know, and he's definitely got, you know, a bit of the sort of madman about him, which I love. You know, I love motorbike racers who are a bit mad. You know, that's what really kind of gets me going. You know, and I'd put people like Marquez like that. You know, they're just kind of prepared to go, you know, win by any means necessary. That's what I want to see, you know. And Bezzecchi's a bit like that. He's a bit wild and he's learning, you know. I think by next year, yeah, so I don't think the bike makes a huge amount of difference. I think the technical backup does. Like, Martin has got exactly the same contract as Bagnaia. That's the only way Ducati could hang on to him. So he's on the same money and he's got the same amount of electronics engineers, and that's the most important thing. And the electronics engineers are the guys you never see, and girls that you never see in MotoGP, because there's the back of the garage, the big red wall or the big purple wall or whatever it is behind there, and you never see that on telly. There's four or five people tapping away on their laptops all weekend, you know, and then there's another bunch back at the factory doing the same thing. And in Martin's contract, he has the same amount of electronics engineers behind his wall as Bagnaia does, and that's hugely important. So that's the kind of nice thing about it, I guess. I mean, when did we last have two guys fighting for the championship on the same bike? Would that be like Rossi and Lorenzo maybe on the Yamaha? Doesn't happen that often. And it makes for a sort of intriguing, well, it just makes everything closer, doesn't it? You know, you don't have to think, well, is this track going to suit the Honda or the Ducati? You know, they're both on the same bikes. It's all down to them, you know, which is pretty
it
cool.
Also underlines, Matt, just how much of an advantage Ducati have got, because all of that lot is coordinated together, and all of those riders that, and you can guess that even though Grassini might be just a fraction backwards in the pecking order at this point in their evolution, I can see that changing now that Marc Marquez is on board as well, and even more engineers getting involved behind that cover that you've been talking about. But with eight bikes on the grid and all of that data being assimilated, is that the right word? I don't know, brought together so that they can actually work out every single nuance that's going on each and every track, that has got to be an advantage. And I would imagine Honda, and particularly Yamaha, are up against it regarding
absolutely.
That. You know, if you've only got two bikes out on the track like Yamaha have, they really are on a hiding to nothing.
Yeah. You've not got a chance. And it's not just the data from the old way that we look at it, i.e. that all their eight riders can look at the data of all the other riders. So if they're struggling at one corner with their line or their speed or where they open the throttle, they've got seven guys to look at, including the, you know. So even if Banaya is struggling with a corner, maybe one of the other riders is doing that corner better, and he can look at it and look at the lines, look at whether how much brake pressure they're using, where they're getting on the throttle, that kind of stuff. But even also now, what's increasingly important is computer modeling and computer simulation, which is becoming more and more important. I mean, it's been huge in Formula One for some years, and it's increases in importance the less practice time you get, because you don't have as much time to fix problems on the bike, on the track. So you feed all your data into the computer, and it'll run 1,000 simulation laps or 1,000 simulations of that corner, and it'll pop up with three solutions that it thinks are worth trying on the bike. And then the engineers sit down, okay, we'll try 1, 2, and 3 or 1 and 2. So it gives them a huge advantage from that point of view as well. And the computer simulation thing is huge now. And a fascinating thing, and it includes artificial intelligence, it includes machine learning, deep machine learning, all these sort of things. And I happen to know that Ducati have got some very special software that allows them to process this stuff super quick. So they're kind of ahead in so many ways at the moment, not just mechanically, but also kind of, you know, in your digital zeros and ones world, you know, which is becoming more and more important.
Absolutely. You mentioned earlier on MotoGP is entering a bit of an insane run towards the end of the season. It's been a bit of an insane year, really, when you think back and sprint races being introduced what seemed to be fairly last minute. And it wasn't just, you know, they didn't do the F1 thing of we'll try a couple out, see how they go. Straight away, every single race, riders and teams go, well, hang on a minute, well, do we get paid more? Now we're getting into the latter end of the season, nope. Matt. How do you look back at the sprint races and this sort of rejigged format for MotoGP this year? Do you think it's been a success? Will there be changes made for next year?
I have to say I wasn't a fan to start off with, and I'm still not. I mean, you know, everybody said, oh, the racing and the sprints is going to be insane. It's going to be amazing. And like it was for the first one or two, and then everybody started hurting themselves. And so everybody, you know, the sprints, pretty much just, I mean, it's another race, yep, so that's cool, but I, you know, to me it's meant to be Grand Prix racing. I don't see the best thing would have been done to change the rules to make the racing better rather than to have more races, you know, with just as little overtaking. And the fact is that the number of riders missing, and this is all done in data that I've seen, the number of riders missing races through injury this year has tripled since last year. Tripled. We haven't had a full grid of full-time riders all year. We're on what, round 13, 14? We've had 14 rounds and we haven't had one full grid all season because there's been at least one rider hurt, which isn't good for the championship. If you've got guys like, you know, guys like Folger, Bradle, think of all the other replacement riders.
Lecuona.
Pirro. You know, they're all awesome. Yeah, exactly. They're all awesome riders, but you put them on a MotoGP bike and they're at the back. So, you know, what's that doing to the promotion of the championship? If you've got a quarter of the grid of bloody test riders riding around at the back. I mean, you know, if you're injuring all your star riders, you know, the guys, you know, that people turn on their televisions to watch, what is that doing to the championship? So, you know,
Let me kind of jump across some of that then, Matt, if I can.
Go on.
From what I've actually looked at, I mean, a lot of the accidents that we've seen, a lot of the injuries that we've seen have come from the main GP race on the Sunday, not from the sprint race. Are you saying that the sprint race is putting so much more pressure on them that even when we get to Sunday, that it's causing them some kind of fatigue phenomena that is creating more accidents on the day?
I don't think it's the biggest increase, and I've seen all the data, is in practice, of injuries sustained in practice. And that's because, you know, you've reduced the amount of practice, and therefore you're putting more pressure on the riders to, and it was particularly this, you know, when they had the first practice session as a timed session, was just counting towards Q2, was insane. You've got guys going out, they've been out for half an hour, and they're putting on soft tires, and just Paul Espargaro, you know, he told me that he, you know, every qualifying lap is like losing a life. You know, these guys are absolutely, well, over the limit every time you do a qualifying lap. You know, so if you are forcing riders to do more qualifying laps, then they're going to get hurt more. And this is the situation we're in.
Isn't that a gain though, Matt? Down to the fact that these races are won or lost in the first couple of corners quite often, in as much as they've got to be on the front two rows of the grid with the aero and the like that we've got at the moment. If they don't get
100%,
opportunistic passes done early on in the race, then they're done for in the race.
Yeah, 100%. And that's what I'm talking about, the technical mess that we're in. You know, we kind of keep backing MotoGP. It's not us, it's not me. It's MotoGP keeps backing itself into a corner with the format, the rules, the technology. It's just getting, yeah, you're right. Everybody has to go mad. We've had the last five race weekends, we've had four turn one pileups. I mean, it's just daft. And a lot of that is down to, the start devices. You know, that everybody arrives at the foot, it's no longer counts for rider skill. You know, you just nail it and you just go to the, and everybody arrives at the first corner at the same time. And what happens then, of course, and it's not only, exactly. And it's not only that, they have to smash the front brake really hard to disengage the front hole, the hole shot device. And if they don't, you know, they're screwed for the first few corners. So you know, and if they smash the front brake too hard, they lock the front and crash. And you know what I mean? I mean, you would struggle to come up with a set of rules and technology that made it more risky. You really would, you know. And that's why so many people are getting hurt. And like I say, I just don't think that's a good way to promote the championship, having half your riders in bloody hospital, you know.
So what would you see next year then?
We need to, well, nothing will happen until somebody gets badly hurt or worse, because that's just the way it is. You know, we're getting riders hurt, but, you know, thank God, you know, touch wood, you know, none of them have been like horrific injuries. They're the usual collarbones, wrists and so on. But yeah, I would get rid of the hole shot devices, 100%. 100%. Just get rid of the bloody things. Get rid of the ride height devices. Reduce aero. You know, you need some downforce aero because the bikes are going so fast now. But reduce aero by 50, 75%. That's, you know, if I was king of MotoGP, that's what I would do. But because of the unanimity rule with the MSMA, it's not possible. None of it will happen. The only way Dorna can change stuff is if it's presumed to be a safety issue. And I would say that is the case, you know, with the whole shot devices. I mean, four pileups in five race weekends. That's, to me, it's pretty obvious what's going on, you know. But what you said about, you know, the way all the riders have, you know, you've got two laps to get past everybody. That's where you can like attack, you know, and that's also before your front tire pressure comes up, which is another kind of technical mess thing to throw into the technical mess mix. You know, it's just kind of like, oh my God, you know, how have we created this kind of monster that we've created? I mean, I still love MotoGP, of course I do. You know, I can watch what's a fairly boring race and really enjoy it because I'm looking at all the nuances going on and blah blah blah, you know. So, but you know, I'd much rather see more overtaking, you know, and where we're going is we got less overtaking, more injuries, blah blah blah. I could go on all day, but you don't want me to.
Well,
that's part two.
Yeah, that is part two. Look, we are getting towards the end though. We'll be back, Keith and I'll be back on Thursday for Extra to look forward to Indonesia this weekend. But Matt, thank you so much for taking the time. And where can people find and hear you if they would like to seek you out, if they haven't done so already?
If they really want to. I'm everywhere, I'm afraid. I'm hard to avoid, sorry. So I'm Peter Bom, who's a MotoGP sort of engineer. I've started doing a podcast called the Oxley Bom MotoGP podcast. So he's a garage guy, right? So he knows everything that I don't. So he's fantastic. And what else? Writing wise, I'm on, you know, I do blogs every week and MotoGP race reports on motorsportmagazine.com, I think it's called, or is that motorsportmagazine.co.uk, one of those. Just Google my name and Motorsport Magazine and you'll find it, you know.
Brilliant.
Yeah, thanks. No, it's been great. And me and Keith could chat bikes all day, couldn't we? So, you know, we've done it for an hour and I've started just getting warmed up.
Well, definitely, though, in that case, I have to get you back for more. lovely. All right, then. We'll end it there, then. Go and check out Matt's podcast as well. Keith and I back on Thursday for Extra. We've also got on the channel, you can check out Keith's chat with Carl Fogarty, part one and two out now to enjoy. They went down to the Stirrup Cup and had a pub to have a good chinwag, so it's really worth having a little listen there. Back on Extra for Thursday to look at all things Indonesia. Any questions, omgmotogp@gmail.com, or jot them down in the YouTube or on social media, and we'll try and seek them out. And always remember to leave a review. Very important wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll see you right back here a little later on this week. My thanks to Keith Hewitt, Matt Oxley. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.